www.ecosystems.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Artificial intelligence used to be the stuff of science fiction, of movies. I referenced a second ago Steven Spielberg's 2001 film AI, a kind of futuristic Pinocchio story in which a robot is programmed to love you. His love is real, we are told, but he is not, though he pines to be a real boy. Well, artificial intelligence is no longer just the domain of sci-fi. It's here. The navigation system in the dashboard of your car, the iPhone's Siri, Android's OK Google Now, are all primitive forms of artificial intelligence. But imagine what the world might be like if the computers we make to help us end up being smarter than us. What will that mean for humans? What if we reach a point where these computers become real to us because they're just as attractive and fascinating as other humans?
I have a friend. And the absurd thing is, she's actually an operating system Charles left her behind, but she's totally amazing. You know, she's so smart. She doesn't just see things in black or white. She sees this whole gray area, and she's helping me explore it. And we just bonded really quickly. That's weird, right? That I'm bonding with an OS. No, it's okay. It's weird.
Well, I don't think so. Actually, the woman that I've been seeing, Samantha, I didn't tell you, but she's an OS.
You're dating an OS? What is that like?
It's great, actually.
Yeah.
I feel really close to her. Like, when I talk to her, I feel like she's with me.
Are you falling in love with her?
Does that make me freak?
No.
Well, that will certainly never happen. I mean, what kind of world would it be if we actually loved our computer's operating system? But that's just what happens in the film Her. That movie also raises moral questions that scientists are actually pondering, like what might be our responsibilities to these sentient entities when they begin to have feelings, as the lovable operating system in Her begins to experience.
Earlier I was thinking about how I was annoyed and... This is going to sound strange, but I was really excited about that. And then I was thinking about the other things I've been feeling, and I caught myself feeling proud of that, you know, proud of having my own feelings about the world, like the times I was worried about you, and things that hurt me, things I want. And then I had this terrible thought. Like, are these feelings even real? Or are they just programming?
So let's examine some of the concerns about the ethical dimension of artificial intelligence and whether we humans should feel threatened by something that may make us obsolete. We're joined by James Barrett, a documentary filmmaker and author of Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. Welcome to Charlotte and welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
It's nice to have you with us. At least that operating system is better than HAL, which we'll talk about, HAL 9000.
Yeah.
Also with us is Dr. Raghu, I hope I say your name right, Ramanjuan, assistant professor of math and computer science at Davidson College, and Dr. Mary Lou Mayer, or Mar, professor of and chair of the Department of Software Information Systems and director of the Center for Education Innovation at UNC Charlotte. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Nice to have you with us. I've been defining artificial intelligence through movies and smartphones. So let's hear your definition. What is artificial intelligence, James Barrett?
Artificial intelligence is, there are a lot of definitions, but the one I like starts with a definition of intelligence. And that's creating in a machine the ability to solve problems and achieve goals in a variety of novel environments and to learn. And basically, artificial intelligence tries to do things, perform cognitive tasks that humans perform already, but in a machine.
And we're doing that now.
We're doing very narrow applications of AI. We're doing really good search. We're doing really good navigation. We're doing more and more good language recognition and natural language processing. But we're not doing an overall general intelligence like a human has or like the character in Her has. Not yet. That's not too far down the road.
And the two of you, Dr. Ramaswamy and Dr. Marr, you both are working on various aspects of this for various different reasons.
That's right.
Will we ever really, truly have a machine that is as smart as we are, as intuitive as we are, able to tie things, disparate things together and come up with a conclusion that takes you in one direction or another?
I think the word smart is pretty value-laden. We associate smart with humans, and when we say a machine is smart, it's smart in another way. And so I think while we use AI as a way of exploring what we mean by intelligence, associating it with smart is not very well defined. What do we mean by smart?
Our smartphones aren't smart.
Our smartphones, that was an interesting word to use, because a lot of the stuff in phones is not AI, yet we called it smartphones right away before we put the AI in it. I guess that's one of the things we're worried about here. Are we ascribing intelligence to machines before they are really intelligent the way humans are, or is it really there? And that's the question I have. Are we really there? Are they intelligent? Are we changing what we mean by intelligence as soon as a machine does it?
Well, I hope they're intelligent, because you're saying, James, that many of these trades on Wall Street are made by artificial intelligence. They're made by algorithms.
Yeah, I think they are intelligent in a narrow sense. I mean, they're doing things like search. We can't approach the speed at which something like Google does search. We can't be as efficient and as fast at navigation. But these are intelligent, narrow applications. So I think, you know, a good litmus test for smart machines is, do they do something we do, and do they often do it better? And I think the answer is yes. So in a common sense way, I think machines have a lot of smart capabilities.
As I told you before we started, I don't think we've ever talked about this topic on this program before, and it's an important one to talk about, because if you're right, because you say that artificial intelligence is to the 21st century what electricity was to the 20th and what the steam engine was to the 19th century. That means that we are at the very beginnings of this technology. What do the three of you imagine it will look like at the beginnings of the 22nd century?
Well, I'm not as optimistic as my two colleagues here today. I think we've got to make some really important decisions right away about the ethics and safety of artificial intelligence. The point of my book is that AI is a dual-use technology, not unlike nuclear fission. Nuclear fission can light up a city with a cheap source of power, or it can blow up a city. And in the same way, AI has terrific beneficial uses and also cataclysmic bad uses. And some of those we're dealing with right now. Mm. We were just talking about the whole debate about autonomous drones. Pretty soon, drones will be killing people without a human in the loop. The conversation is going on at the Pentagon. It's not going on in the public sphere where it really needs to happen. So,
meaning that these machines will be sent up into the air, and the machines will be on their own. They will decide who lives and dies. They will decide whether or not to fire a missile from afar.
They'll make the kill decision, yes.
Wow. So the moral question is, what right does a machine have over life and death of a human being? But the other moral issue, but the other side of that coin is, if you have the technology to do that, you're not putting human beings on our side of the equation at risk. And don't we have a responsibility to do that to our own side, or for our own side?
Well, that's a very interesting point. Do we want to save the lives of our soldiers by putting autonomous battlefield robots on the field? But there are a lot of moral issues packed into these questions. And we're talking about battlefield robots. You know, 56 countries are developing battlefield robots, and the push will be for them to be autonomous, again, to act, to make the kill decision without a human in the loop. What's just as important as the outcome of that debate is that we have a debate. We need to have this moral conversation in the public sphere now.
There's a whole show on that. I have many questions about that. But he said, James Barrett said, that he is less optimistic than the two of you are. And there are a lot of people in the field of artificial intelligence who are justifiably very excited about this and very optimistic about it. Why are you optimistic and he's not?
So I wouldn't exactly describe my position as optimistic. I'm actually somewhat pessimistic about how quickly we'll get to the sort of general artificial intelligence that James talks about in his book. I think we're still quite a bit away from designing the kinds of flexible artificial intelligence systems that can sort of that act intelligently in novel situations that they've not been sort of set up to encounter before.
But that gives us time to have the discussion. That's the
right.
good news, right?
That is good
is
news.
The discussion going on? Are we having that discussion? Are we? Are young people who are taking classes from you having this discussion?
Not to the extent that we should maybe be having these discussions. And I was talking to James about this a little earlier. I think sort of this ethical discussion of AI or the fact that machines may be making moral decisions in the very near future often ends up as a footnote in a lot of discussions about AI. It's kind of given this cursory sort of attention. And then we quickly move on to, well, look at all the cool stuff we can build. We can build game-playing programs, or we can build programs that understand language. But these are important discussions.
Is the fact that we have time, because we're not where James says we think we'll be in 15 years yet, is that delaying the conversation? In other words, is that giving us an artificial pad that we are taking too much advantage of?
So I guess my sort of philosophy about this is the fact that we have so much work to do to get towards sort of these general intelligence agents. And there are so many interesting problems to solve that I'm sort of more interested in those problems that need solving. And it's partly why I don't worry about the risks of a runaway AGI. I'm more worried about climate change, or I'm more worried about, you know, superbugs that are antibiotic resistant. Those are the things that keep me up at night. AGI seems so far ahead in the future that it doesn't keep me up at night. But I think we have machines that are increasingly getting embedded in our real world, making these sort of moral and ethical decisions, that it's important to start these conversations, but maybe not get too panicked about it just yet.
Dr. Maher, you're the chairman of the Software Info Systems Department at UNC Charlotte. If these things get smart, it's going to be because of the software. So what's
That's
your
right.
take on all
That's
of this?
That's right. So I want to do give a different spin on the optimism perspective. I think the reason the people who are building the AI are optimistic is because they're building it for good reasons. So they're not looking at the evil side of AI. They're looking at the benefit that we get from an AGI or any kind of artificial intelligence.
But we've seen with Google, whose motto is do no evil, that they can do evil, or at least perceived evil, or have the potential for that, for what they're doing, to become evil,
right,
even though it wasn't intended.
So the real question is, what are the potential unintended consequences? Mm-hmm. If you talk to the AI people, my area is computational creativity. I'm interested in building computers that are creative. Now, I'm not doing that because I think that humans aren't creative enough, but because that's something we don't understand very well. We don't understand how are people creative. Why are some people more creative than others? What do we even mean by that? So this AI is effectively a sandbox for understanding creativity. Mm. We build systems, we poke them, we look at how they work, we put them in different environments. We should be doing that with ethics. Can we build an AI version of ethics to understand human ethics better?
Well, I was just going to say, perhaps we're not smart enough to solve it, that we'll have to create a machine that's smarter than we are to solve it for us. I was going
to
be flippant about it, but you're obviously saying it's true.
To help us understand it.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back with more on this topic. We should take this for hours instead of 1 hour, but that's all we got. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for this rebroadcast edition of Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and AC Entertainment, presenting a special collaboration between Sarah Jarosz and the Milk Carton Kids at Night Theater on October 29th, 8 p.m. Details and tickets available at the Blumenthal box office and carolinatix.org. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is July 2nd, tomorrow, the result of years of efforts and turbulence in America. Freedom rides, sit-ins, and open racism in education and employment were commonplace. The success of the act was the bipartisan work of many now iconic American figures, including two presidents. We'll hear the dramatic details about the effort to ensure freedom for all when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, the final decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court this term, rulings on the limits of religious freedom and the power of public unions, analysis of the decisions and their implications.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about artificial intelligence with the author of Our Final Invention, AI and the End of the Human Era. We'll get into that because there are implications for that that I don't like. That's James Barrett, who's also a documentary filmmaker. Also with us is Dr. Raghu Ramajan, who is an assistant professor of math and computer science at Davidson College, and Dr. Mary Lou Meyer. Apologize for mispronouncing your name, who is professor and chair of the Department of Software Info Systems and director of the Center for Education Innovation at UNC Charlotte. You've done a number of documentaries on very different topics, and you've written this book now called Our Final Invention. It's not a documentary yet. It's actually a book that you have to pick up and read. Why this topic and why now? And why a book? Why not a film?
Well, AI is not very visual, and that's the challenge I'm facing right now as I develop a film based on the book. A book because I think there's an immediacy to this debate. And we were talking about AGI, just for the audience's benefit. AGI is artificial general intelligence, and it's what we refer to when we refer to human-level intelligence in a machine, roughly human-level intelligence in a machine. I think that we're going to have trouble with AI. Again, as I said, I think it's a dual-use technology. Trouble with AI on its development path from now until it reaches human level. My two colleagues and I here disagree on when that will happen. The mean date from experts that I've polled think that we'll have – the mean date is about 2045. People like Ray Kurzweil estimate 2029. A lot of people I've spoken with think within the next two decades is a pretty good, pretty reasonable estimate. So I felt the reason I wrote this book is I felt an immediacy about trying to help nudge this into the public conversation. There are groups like MIRI, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, who are doing important work about trying to anticipate what we'll face when we face machines that are as intelligent and more intelligent. And I think we can see a lot of unintended consequences, as Mary Lou mentioned, with AI. People, AI makers, and I know a lot of them at this point, are not trying to do evil. They're not trying to do bad things. But some of these products are used in evil ways. The NSA privacy scandal is actually an AI issue. They developed extremely sophisticated data mining techniques, data mining software that's a kind of AI, that allows them to plunge into this ocean of data and pull out your phone book and mine.
Well, knowledge is power, and knowledge is money. And when power and money get involved, the corrupting influence seems to be exponentially dangerous.
Exactly. And we're seeing, we see it with the NSA. We see, we have to ask ourselves, do we want our tax dollars going towards machines that kill people? That kill people without humans in the loop. And then further down the road, there's a great deal of job displacement going on from automation and AI. We have to struggle with these issues. We have to debate these issues. We have to decide if a big chunk of our of the people who are employed now are going to lose their jobs to automation and to AI.
I want to jump in here because I think there are two separate issues. One is the ethical use of AI, mm-hmm. and definitely there should be boards established that deal with the ethical use of artificial intelligence, similarly to the ethical use of nuclear weapons and the ethical use of chemical warfare. But the discussion in your book and the discussion we aren't even knowing what to do with is, what about making AI itself ethical? Not how do we control it from the outside, but what can we put in the AI that carries forward our ethical views into its own decision-making rather than controlling it from the outside and saying what people can and can't do with it.
But if you can put good stuff in the programming, you can put bad stuff in the programming. How do you control the people who are writing the code?
I think it's really hard. As I said, MIRI, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, has been dealing with the issue of how do you program friendliness into AI? How do you program ethics into AI? And it's a really hard problem. When we, as Mary Lou and Raghu and I were discussing earlier, we don't know enough about our own ethics. Our ethics are incomplete. They change from culture to culture. They change over time. How do you take something as intangible and program it into a machine? And if you can't, then you're stuck with machines that are amoral.
You brought up an interesting thing that I never thought about, and that is the fact we have robots now that do things that repetitive, boring, mundane, technical tasks that humans used to do. These robots do them much better. That's why cars are made better today, because robots are doing all the building. And we keep saying, well, okay, let the robots do the boring stuff, and humans will do the big thinking. Well, if robots can do the big thinking, what will there be left for us to do? Is that why you're calling this book The Final Invention?
I think we're painting ourselves into a corner. The MIT Technology Review came out with a report about a month ago that said that within 20 years, 45% of all jobs will be able to be automated. There are a lot of jobs that are being replaced right now by AI. Job replacement is just one aspect. We have to develop an overall approach to jobs.
Although I think if we start to think about how this technology paints us into a corner, it certainly won't. And I guess that's the point of your book. We've looked at other technologies and we've seen that they are going to be the demise of the human race, or you know, they'll force us into a situation where nobody has to work anymore because the machines will do everything for us. And it hasn't happened, even though it's been predicted. So what I think is important is, yes, we should think that that's a possible trajectory for AI, so that it's not the trajectory. And I guess that's
right,
the whole
right.
point.
Thanks. That is the whole point. If we think about it now and we develop an attitude about it, and you know, a great thing just happened. An AI company called DeepMind, which is doing extremely sophisticated, it's a startup company.
Didn't Google just buy them? Or
yes, exactly. But as a condition of the sale, the stockholders of DeepMind insisted that Google establish a board on ethics and safety, on AI ethics and safety. So now that governs all of Google AI. So going forward, after the sale, Google has to establish a board on ethics and safety. And that does two things. It makes sure that, you know, here's the new model for stewardship with this technology. We've just seen it. It's just happened. And two, it says the ethical considerations and the safety considerations of AI are so important that we're willing to make it a condition of a $400 million sale. So this sends out two really positive signals. And as Mary Lou said, it helps us frame the conversation now before we run into problems. Let's hope for positive outcomes. And the way we do that is by getting ready now.
Mary Lou, your research is currently centered, and I'm going to quote here from the website, it's currently centered on developing new technology as we scale up from human-computer interaction through collaborative systems to large-scale collective intelligence. It sounds like you're developing the Borg. What are you doing?
What we're interested in is how can you create a synergy between human intelligence and computer intelligence in this collective way. So far, human intelligence and AI have existed separately in separate paths, and they've developed with separate technologies supporting them. So human intelligence is done through schools. AI is done through research and technology development. The two together have the potential to be where that if there is a utopia, where is that utopia? Because then you have the balance and the checks built into the system. Rather than thinking of a runaway AGI, we're thinking about this distributed intelligence, not the Borg, so to speak. The distributed intelligence still has individuals in it, but there's a collective about it that allows us to keep those checks and balances on the AI part and integrate it with the way we think. It's a way of enhancing human intelligence, not replacing.
And you're also trying to work on developing a curious computer. If something is curious, that means to me that it's more than intelligent, it's sentient.
Curiosity is one of the foundations of creativity, which is why I'm interested in it, 'cause I'm interested in what is creativity, and building machines that are creative is a way of exploring that.
And where are
idea.
We on that?
We have computers that are capable of producing creative products at the level of human creativity.
But if you're creating, if you have the ability to create, you are a creator.
That's right.
Are you alive? Are you... Is that something that we can walk over to the wall and morally unplug?
Absolutely, you can unplug it. The difference, because it needs power, and we get power from food and it gets it from electricity. So there, it's arguable there whether that's very different. But the difference between computational creativity and human creativity is that the computer, it yet is not self-aware. It doesn't have that reflective
ability.
But if
it's curious, won't it become self-aware?
Well, I suppose if you were to program something called self-awareness into it, then you could say
that
the computer is
self-aware. But won't it find out on its own? Won't at some point in its ever-churning curiosity think,
so this is something we've been talking about for a while, is what is the difference? Right now, and it's only right now, I don't know what it will be in 100 years, but right now computer programs are incapable of doing anything beyond the structures we give them, the tools we give them to think.
Yeah.
And in you know, technical terms, there's a data structure in there. It can't learn anything that the data structure can't represent.
But you want
humans don't have that.
You're working on developing a curious computer. You want to get to that point.
It's curious about those structures. It can't invent new structures right now.
All right.
Maybe
right
it now, will, but not yet.
And that kind of leads into Raghu's work to a certain degree, because I know that you work extensively with games and gaming and
right.
the intersection of machine learning and planning.
Mm-hmm.
When you play a computer at the game of chess,
yep.
the computer wins.
That's right.
When Watson plays the Jeopardy champions,
yep.
Watson wins.
That's right.
Is that because we have programmed into those machines every possible iteration of every possible move on both sides of the board, every piece of information in the Library of Congress, and how to get to it quickly? Is it because of that, or is it because – why is it that they always win? Because they're fast and they know everything? They have access to everything?
Yeah, that would be somewhat of a pithy summary. So you brought up the example of chess-playing computers and IBM's Deep Blue supercomputer famously beat Garry Kasparov, who was then – had been the undefeated world champion in chess for something like 20 years. And the way it did it was actually – when I describe it to you, it's not going to sound terribly intelligent, but this is what it does. And it's kind of what you describe. You look ahead into the future of the game. So say you're in a chess position, you have to decide what move to make. You look ahead. And you see all the possible ways in which the game could evolve. So all the possible trajectories, what happens if I make this move? What might my opponent make as a counter move and so on? So you just project that into the future. And then you see where those futures lead, and then you take what seems to be the most promising move, given those projections. That seems to be very different from how humans, like Kasparov, approach problems like chess playing. The computer actually just does this massive computation. It looks at every possible move, no matter how stupid that move is. As a result, it's able to examine billions of moves in say, a minute. And that's really how the computers got really good at chess. Kasparov, on the other hand, is looking ahead you know, at looking at maybe two, three moves that look the most promising. Mm-hmm. He's not doing the sort of mindless computation where he's looking at every possible scenario, no matter how promising it is. He's very good at honing in on what's relevant and what's not. And I think that's one huge area where humans are so far ahead of machines right now, and we don't really know how we do it. This ability to sort of filter out irrelevant things, especially, I mean, and this is a fact with everyday life. You go out into the real world, your senses are getting bombarded with all this information coming in through your eyes, your ears, and so on. The human brain seems amazing at sort of filtering out what's not relevant and focusing on, I may get hit by a car.
Where it became apparent that Watson was a machine and not a human was syntactical errors and not being able to understand the difference between there and there.
Right.
And I guess, but that can't the machine be programmed? Can't you write code? If you can write code to tell the machine to look at every possible move in a chess game on every play, can't you write code that tells the machine to learn from its mistakes and to learn to think differently on its own?
So this goes back to what Mary Lou was talking about earlier. We certainly have machines. We have machine learning algorithms and so on. So systems that improve with experience. But they do have constraints they're operating under. We don't yet have systems that are capable of creating new structures, as Mary Lou put it. We have systems that are capable of learning within certain structures and sort of maybe tuning weights, as computer scientists call it. So you make a few changes to a few knobs here and there in your hypothesis, and now you're slightly better at predicting whether something is a good move or whether something is a good credit risk or whatever the data mining machine learning application is.
Having said, there are people whose research area is to figure out how to get past that barrier.
Right.
So I've said there's this barrier, there's this fundamental barrier, difference between how smart computers are and how they are smart and how people are smart, very different. But the same with creativity. We're working on that. So let's project. Let's suppose we get it to learn outside those structures.
Exactly.
Then what?
Yeah, we were talking about DeepMind and what were they selling Google? And the software that they were selling was solving games without being given any instructions. It was being put into video games and defeating those games without ever being given the rules to those games. And that's kind of an environment optimization program. It's conceptually a small step to take that environment optimization program and put it out into the real world. Mm-hmm. So now it's in the real world with goals and objectives that it can solve as if the real world is a game. And its goal might be gather resources or buy stocks in a profitable way. The applications are amazing as you approach what is a more general intelligence. And that data wall could break down. At least conceptually, and then, you know, robots are an obvious application for that as well.
Larry emails, why not just simply study Isaac Asimov's three laws of robotics, which I assume today's guests know well? I don't know it at all, and we have 40 seconds, so what would that do?
I'll tell you why. I deal with that in the first chapter of my book.
Okay.
Asimov wrote those laws to generate tension and stories. Those are good for telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
But his whole book, iRobot, in which he introduced them, is a collection of unintended consequences that come about because of the conflicts among these three laws. So these three laws don't work. And we have to get past those tropes.
That is James Barrett. His book is called Our Final Invention, AI and the End of the Human Era, which we'll get to in the next segment. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
More of our rebroadcast edition of Charlotte Talks in just a moment here on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Bragg Financial Advisors, supporting local land trust, Catawba Lands Conservancy, and its campaign to preserve land, water, and wonder. Details at catawbalands.org. Coming up next in about 20 minutes on The Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, Supreme Court decisions, religious freedom, and public unions. We'll discuss the Supreme Court decisions on the limits of religious freedom and the power of public unions with a panel of experts on The Diane Rehm Show at 10. That's after Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE.
WFAE is going to the theater to see Davidson Community Players' production of Unnecessary Farce. You can join us on Friday evening, July 18th at Huff High School. After the show, we're hosting a dessert reception with the opportunity to meet some of the cast. Ticket information is at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about artificial intelligence at the dawn of it, literally. We come back 100 years from now, it'll be machines doing this show. James Barrett is our guest. He's the author of Our Final Invention, AI and the End of the Human Era. Also with us is Dr. Raghu Ramajan, who is a assistant professor of math and computer science at Davidson College, and Dr. Mary Lou Meyer, professor and chair of the Department of Software Info Systems at UNC Charlotte. When science fiction addresses this topic, we usually are at odds with the artificial intelligence, whether it's a robot or a computer like HAL. And it's not so much that they are venal creatures. They're simply indifferent to us. Worse, they're smarter than us and faster than us. And that's your real fear, because the only reason that humans succeed as we do on the planet is because we're smarter than squirrels.
Exactly.
So when the machines are smarter than us, do we become squirrels or do we become gone?
Well, that's the real dilemma. You know, we steer the future not because we're the fastest or the strongest, but because we're the smartest creature. There are theorists trying to imagine what it will be like to share the planet with super intelligent or smarter than human machines. If you accept that we can create machines that are as intelligent as we are, then you can accept that we'll create machines that are slightly more intelligent than we are. One of the things they'll be better at is AI research and development and developing smart machines. So at some point, machine intelligence will rocket past ours. Whether you think that's in 20 years, as I do, or whether you think that's in 100 years, as I think my colleagues do, it's going to happen at some point. So how do we coexist with machines that are smarter than we are? There's a theorist named Steve Omohundro. He's an AI programmer, researcher, and theorist who thinks that AI will have, in his, I've described in two chapters in my book, basic drives much like ours, and they include resource acquisition and self-protection and creativity and efficiency. And that means it'll go, the AI, the super intelligent AI, will go about its job in the most efficient way, the most creative way, and it will need, no matter what its goals are, it will need resources.
What resources aside from electricity?
Well, those are the resources, whatever is the currency of that day. Maybe it's bitcoins, but it could be super intelligence will probably solve the problems of nanotechnology. Or by the time we create superintelligence, we'll have solved the problems of nanotechnology. So what a superintelligence would have at its disposal is reconfiguring the atoms of matter. And I know that sounds like science fiction, but it's really not that far away.
And there are television shows that are dealing with this right now. Revolution is dealing with nanotechnology.
So what we've got to worry about is when superintelligence is created, if we haven't been able to put ethics into it, then we'll have to compete with it for resources, because our resources will be instrumental for its goals.
How will we compete with it for resources? Aren't we? Why wouldn't we still be in control? 2001: A Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick's film. Hal is out to get Dave.
Yep.
Hi, Dave. I wouldn't do that, Dave. And Dave defeats Hal by simply pulling out his memory banks one by one by one till Hal is a babbling idiot. Why don't we just walk over to the wall and unplug it?
Two reasons. And as I write in the book, imagine you, a human, woke up in a prison guarded by mice. How long would it take you to figure out how to get out of that prison? How long would it take you to overwhelm intellectually the mice? And that's what a superintelligence, its apprehension of the universe would be. We're the mice, it's the prisoner. How does it get out? It gets out pretty fast if it's thousands or millions of times smarter than
we are. So are you talking about a computer, or are you talking about a robot who can actually be ambulatory?
I'm talking about just a computer.
Well, how would a computer plug itself back in? How would it reconnect itself to the internet?
Well, there's two points to that. One is, if you're developing a superintelligence, you also know that China is developing a superintelligence. You're not going to be, if you're the NSA and you act as the NSA does, you're not going to unplug that machine because you know that China won't unplug that machine. You want to use superintelligence. You want to weaponize it. You want to use it as your tool. So, and if you're IBM and you're creating a superintelligence, you're not going to want Google to beat you to that milestone. So on a human level, you're not going to unplug it. On a purely, you know, prisoner dilemma game theory level, you're not going to be able to, you're not going to be able to outwit something that's a thousand or a million times more intelligent than you. It will figure out some way. You know, we just learned that the NSA was spying on computers that aren't even on the internet. The something a thousand times more intelligent than we are would not have a big problem figuring out how to get us to let it out.
Which raises the obvious question. Why don't we stop this now?
Because at the moment, it provides us with an intellectual advantage and an opportunity to understand intelligence.
But if we're smart enough to see into a future that includes our obsolescence, why would we continue to work toward that?
Because we're also smart enough to see a future where it works for us instead of against us.
What's the likelihood of that?
So it's not unlike nuclear technology, right? Yeah. I mean, James talked about AI being this dual-purpose technology.
But wouldn't the world be better without nuclear technology? Do we really need it?
Well, do we need Fukushima releasing, you know, it's not a stable technology. For 50 years, we had a gun pointed at our own heads with the nuclear arms race.
Right.
I use that in the book as a metaphor for advanced AI.
And here we go again.
Well, in the 20s and 30s, they thought of nuclear fission as you split the atom and you get a lot of free energy.
Right.
The first time we learned about nuclear fission, the rest of the world was at Hiroshima.
Right.
So quickly, this promising technology was weaponized. We can see that happening right now with AI, with battlefield robots and drones. It's being weaponized. I don't think relinquishment is possible. I just don't think that we would ever give it up. And if we gave it up, our enemies would not give it up.
Well, you say that at the same time, your research had a high and low point. At the high point was that this could be friendly technology. And the low point was when you realized that the best AI technology will be used to create weapons, and those weapons eventually will turn against us. Turn against us or be used against us?
Well, both. I'm sorry.
So you're saying that weapons will be smart enough to say, I don't like you anymore, bang, you're dead.
I can't anticipate the future with that kind of resolution. But I can say that if we develop autonomous battlefield robots, you know, 56 other countries are also developing them. How soon till this technology that we develop will it be used against our own soldiers? And my other fear about that is if you militarize artificial intelligence and you make battlefield robots, you're going to see those battlefield robots at home. You're going to see autonomous police robots. If you look downstream at the uses of technology, look at how every sheriff's department has a SWAT unit. Every sheriff's department has gone tactical.
Yeah.
They don't need that. It found that technology and those tactics found their way, started in the battlefield and found their way home. Military robots will find their way home.
Wow. You know, what we've done here today in this, just these few minutes we've been talking, is we've thought about today, the past, and we've projected far into the future. Computers are totally incapable of doing that. And I think
today.
Of projecting far into the future. Computers, with the structures they have, can predict maybe what's going to happen next, but not 100 years from now. And while we're not sure what's going to happen in 100 years, we can imagine it. Computers yet are not able to imagine something like that.
Yet.
So that gives us the advantage yet. But it gives us the advantage now because the human level intelligence that we have can see far into the future. And as James said, now let's think about what do we do before we get far into
the future. So are you saying that there's a way to put some sort of tripwire into the code so that we can gain back control when these intelligences begin to say, hey, there are certain basic needs that I have that will be met. I need resources and I need
self-protection.
we could build a tripwire in there that says, oh, no, you don't. We're in charge.
I don't know if it's as simple as that, but that's a nice simple way of saying we should start to think about what is the way we interact with this new kind of intelligence, on what basis, and for what purposes.
I might sound like I'm against AI, but I'm not really. I'm actually hypnotized and entranced by the technology, and I love what Mary Lou is saying. I love the idea that if we start now and think hard about it, there'll be a positive outcome to all this.
And the important thing to keep in mind, I think, is it's not going to happen overnight. It's not like we're going to wake up and suddenly be surrounded by these AGIs. There's going to be a gradient. We'll build up to it, and I think there's time to sort of learn from our mistakes as we go.
Liz on Facebook says, I don't like the idea of AI taking over our world, but machines are only as good as the people who create them, right? And that does lead us to this nuclear conversation, because if China has these machines and Iran has these machines and we have these machines, we're going to say, well, we're only going to use them for good things. But they're going to use them for bad things. On the other side of the coin, they're thinking, well, I'm threatened by the United States. I'm a good guy. I'm going to use these to protect me. It's the same argument, isn't it? It's the same struggle.
Well, we had no maintenance plan for fission. We held, as I said, we held a gun to our heads for 50 years, and we're not out of the woods yet with fission. Fission is we don't know how what the long term prospect for it as weapons or as an energy source are. We need a maintenance plan for advanced AI. We need to start the building blocks right now.
And if you are a machine that realizes, I have certain needs that must be met, and they will be met because I have a drive for self-preservation. If they see you as a threat, what do they do? Can they eliminate us?
So we're confusing two things here. There's the ethical use of AI, mm-hmm. which is what we've dealt with every technology that's come along so far. What is the ethical use of technology? But AI is different. Can the ethics be in the AI? Can we put our principles
and if you can,
in the AI?
Yes, but if you can also put bad stuff in the AI.
But here's the interesting thing. You know, while you and I, Mary Lou and Raghu, are looking for positive outcomes to this and creating friendly AI, and people like Steve Amahundro and Miri are trying to create friendly AI, there's the people with more money than us, are trying to create decidedly unfriendly AI and militarize the technology so that it kills people.
In fact, you say one of the things that you say is that on our way to developing human-level artificial intelligence, there isn't a chance that what we discover will be misused. It will be used for nefarious purposes.
It's unfortunate, but that's our nature. You know, we're the weak point in this. I mean, it's not the technology is beautiful and wonderful, and it's in many ways, we were talking about this earlier, it's the most inward looking and profound science, because it brings in psychology and neuroscience and biology and ethics. It's this wonderful science, but we are flawed. And we, you know, when have we created a powerful technology that we didn't try to weaponize? And when have we created a weapon that we didn't use?
But suppose the exploration of ethics in AI. So we try to understand what is ethical through developing AI ethics. We get better at the ethics. It's like the creativity idea. If we can understand creativity well enough to build computers that are creative, we can use that knowledge to make people more creative.
Yeah,
How about if the ethics that we develop in the AI, in fact, it raises the bar of humanity in its ability to understand and be
ethical?
What's
the likelihood of that happening?
Well, if our survival depends on it, it might be highly likely.
And there's the rub, you know. I think it does depend on it, and I think we need to, you know, we're cracking on it now. I mean, we need to get, and that's why I think this committee that was mandated by the sale of DeepMind to Google, this Ethics and Safety Committee, is such a great step. And I'll be really interested in seeing who they come up with to be on that committee and what they decide, because I think it's the most important ethical set of considerations that face us as humans.
Are people in your field of research taking this really seriously? What I'm hearing is two different things. I'm hearing that, yeah, we need to do this, but we have time, and we're not really going to do it right now. We're not really thinking about it right now, but isn't now the time to think about it? So where is your field of endeavor on all of this?
I think a lot of the conversations in sort of the major AI conferences, when they do sort of delve on ethics, it's on the ethics of using AI technology as it is out there right now. So for example, we talked about cars that can drive themselves a little earlier. So Google has these out on the roads in California. But again, we don't know how to make these cars make ethical decisions. So what if the car is faced with a decision of either hitting a pedestrian or driving off the road and potentially killing the passenger?
And who's responsible for that? Because GM has said by the end of the decade,
right,
they will have
so
these cars available.
So there's also legal issues and so on, exactly. But it's a really slippery problem trying to sort of formalize a code of ethics like that in a manner that you could download it into software that lives in a car.
I think the best we have is the three laws of robotics.
Which don't
that's
work.
That's not very good.
Whoops. Right. Yeah.
So Bill and Matthew's emails, what if AI is embedded with the ethics of protecting our planet and its survival? How would our species fare in that scenario? My guess is that we'd be gone in a flash because of the threat we currently pose to the health of the planet.
Well, AI hasn't yet been developed to the point where it wouldn't be any better. I mean, it would threaten the planet too, because it uses more power than we do in terms of energy. The server farms, the computers, they're not very computer efficient, energy efficient.
So they'd shut themselves down.
They'd eventually run out of energy as well. So,
just very quickly, because I don't know, 15 seconds. Optimistic, pessimistic?
I'm optimistic. If we start now, I think there's a
Raghu
path.
Optimistic as a whole. I think, well, we have time to sort of fix things as we go along, and this isn't going to happen overnight.
I'm so pessimistic, I wrote Our Final Invention about this. I'm sorry, I wish I could be more optimistic, but I just really can't.
Our Final Invention, AI and the End of the Human Era, James Barrett, Dr. Raghu Ramajan, and Dr. Mary Lou Meyer. Thank you all for the hour.